This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
In this session of our discussion, please turn to Chapter 10 in Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. I told you a couple of days ago that I considered this the most important chapter of the entire book. In it, he deals with the concept of Christian faith. And the overall question that is raised is the one that I put up on our board here. I have two discussions of religious epistemology that we're going to try to get through in the next session. The first question is faith not based on reason? What is the relationship of faith and reason? And then the next question that we'll consider, hopefully this time out, is faith warranted by evidences? And Michael Martin has discussions of both of these. The first question, is faith not based on reason, is pursued in Chapter 10, titled Faith and Foundationalism. And he goes through various conceptions of faith so that belief in God is based not on reason, but on faith, on some views, or, given the first view of Thomas Aquinas, part of what we believe is based on reason, and then by an extension, through reasonable faith, the rest of the Christian faith is founded. Now, that position of Thomas Aquinas on faith and reason is so well known to all of you that I'm not going to bother, because I'm out of time, to expound it or look at the way he puts it and so forth. He lays out the view of Aquinas, does a fairly adequate job. According to Aquinas, certain truths about God can be known naturally by using the natural man's appeal to the natural world and considerations of natural law. People can know certain things about God. And then on the foundation of that very rational or natural knowledge of God, then Christian faith specifically points out that that God is of such and such a nature. And it requires faith to believe that, faith in divine revelation. Nevertheless, divine revelation is reasonable. It doesn't have the same foundation as, say, the existence of God and that God has a mind and so forth based in the proofs of God's existence. But nevertheless, it is reasonable to believe the things that faith calls for because they are not contrary to reason and there's some evidence for them. So the conception here is you have reason as your foundation, shared with all men, and then you have faith, which is based on reason. When we get to our second question, we'll come back to see what Michael Martin says about the Thomistic approach to faith and reason. When we ask the question, is faith warranted by the evidences? Yeah, the answer is no. He doesn't think that what you and I would call evidential apologetics is very impressive at all. And I want you to see what he says about it and why he says. We'll come back to that one in a minute. The next conception of faith he deals with in Chapter 10, he calls existential faith. And here, Christian faith is thought to be warranted. Christian commitment is thought to be warranted by faith, where faith doesn't have reason as its foundation. The existentialist doesn't agree that you ought to commit yourself to the most rationally probable position. The existentialist appeals to the heart, regardless of what the mind may say, follow your heart. And in some cases, as with Kierkegaard, the more absurd it is, the more religious it is to be committed to. So now, if you're trying to refute Kierkegaard's theism, the approach taken by Michael Martin isn't going to really touch him, right? So the refutation of Kierkegaard is that you shouldn't have this existential faith as the foundation for anything that you follow after. He does refer to Adam's critique of Kierkegaard, which is I think, basically an insightful critique. But in the process of laying this out, Adams says some things that require evidence, and you'll get a criticism of Adams criticizing Kierkegaard that looks very much like the criticism that Michael Martin makes of Thomas Aquinas a few pages back. So we'll come back to that one as well. But the point is, the first conception of faith is it's based on reason. But then there are people who want to turn this around. And now faith is not based on reason if you follow Kierkegaard, but the furthest thing from it. Reason is the sort of thing that is cold and harsh and destroys religious commitment. But there's another approach that says that faith is not based upon universal, impartial reason. And that he calls Wittgensteinian fideism. And I want to take some time going through this. Page 256. Wittgenstein gives us a conception of the nature of religious discourse. Religious discourse, according to Wittgenstein, is embedded in a form of life and has its own rules and logic. I'm hoping that you're remembering my explanation of Wittgenstein from a couple days ago. So religious discourse is embedded in a form of life. It has its own rules and logic. And any attempt to impose standards on this discourse from outside is inappropriate. In fact, the very meaning of terms is going to vary from one language game to another, according to Wittgenstein. It's not the philosopher's task, therefore, to criticize the form of life or its language, but simply to describe them, and when people get into a puzzlement, to help them back to the ordinary usage of their language within that form of life so that the puzzlement can be dispelled. Or in one of his most famous aphorisms, Wittgenstein said, the philosopher's job is to let the fly out of the fly bottle. Okay? How did we get into this mess? If we could just let the fly go loose and get back to ordinary, you know, usage, then you wouldn't have these conceptual problems. But you can't move from one language game and its rules and standards to criticize another. You can just get within each language game, if you will, or form of life more broadly, and resolve the puzzlement that comes when we get away from the ordinary use of those words according to the rules and procedures that have become habitual. Now, given this view, you have something of a presuppositional defense of Christianity available. It only goes so far, I want to make clear. I don't have time to go through it today, but I will. Can I now just give a footnote and expect you to believe me? I'm not doing it that way. I would like you to pursue my article on pragmatism, prejudice, and presuppositionalism in the Foundations of Christian Scholarship, where I have a discussion of Wittgenstein's approach to certainty and why it ends up. I'm going to end up in the same place as our author, Michael Martin, here, in the sense that this is unacceptable because it leads to relativism, subjectivism, prejudice, whatever it may be, however you want to call it. But unlike Michael Martin, I think what Wittgenstein is saying is descriptively very helpful, because this is the way people function in terms of their discourse and reasoning, be it religious or not. If Michael Martin allows a Wittgensteinian analysis, though, of religious discourse as embedded in a form of life which cannot be criticized from outside, and so forth and so on, then he's lost his atheistic argument. And so he's going to have to now criticize Wittgenstein, and that's what we turn to on the top of page 257. So what's wrong with Wittgenstein's understanding of religious discourse? Remember, there are no special rules for religious discourse, in a sense. What Wittgenstein is saying about religious discourse, he would say about the discourse of dentists as well. Okay? Or auto mechanics, or more broadly, the discourse of certain linguistic communities or ethnic communities within a culture. All he's saying is you can isolate religious speakers and do the same sort of analysis as you do with other aspects of the variation in people's reasoning and linguistic habits. Michael Martin says, first of all, the basis for distinguishing one form of life from another, one language game from another, is unclear. Well, one of the reasons it's unclear is because Wittgenstein maintains it is, in the nature of the case, unclear. According to him, forms of life are not watertight compartments, and language games are not watertight, isolated, if you will, sets of the events in language either. In fact, the whole discussion of family resemblance in Wittgenstein should have led Martin away from this criticism. What Wittgenstein says is different forms of life and different language games overlap with each other in ways which are not necessarily predictable or parallel to overlaps elsewhere. The analogy that Wittgenstein is using is a very interesting one. It says, if you get your family together, you take a picture of everyone in the family, there's no one trait that is the family trait. Well, maybe some families have that, but we don't usually have that. And you don't have to have that. He says, rather, you'll have some members of the family, the extended family, resemble one another in, say, their cheekbone structure. Others in terms of the kind of nose they have, or how their eyes are placed, close or far apart, or the color of their eyes correlated with their hair and so forth. There's no one feature that all 30 members of the family have. But they're all in the same family because these features overlap and then features there overlap with another subset of the 30 and then another subset have this feature. And all together, it's kind of like a rope, if you will, that doesn't have one twine that goes all the way through it, but it twists and twists and then one of them ends while others continue. And the rope's very strong. The family resemblance is very obvious, but there's no one thread and there's no one feature that makes it. So it turns out that the language game of religious believers is not isolated from the language game of dentists. They overlap. And some of the rules and connections and procedures that dentists use in the dentist language game, if I can put it that way, will be similar and have a family resemblance even to some of the religious ones. But there are still distinctions to be drawn. So Michael Martin has oversimplified Wittgenstein and he's made him an easy target. How would you distinguish language games? Well, it's not always clear because it's not always clear. See, when you have a thesis that maintains it's not always clear, the criticism, well, that doesn't make things very clear. It's not a very good criticism, is it? According to Michael Martin, a little below the middle of 257, this would have the absurd consequence that members of one Baptist sect would not be able to understand members of another Baptist sect. Now, what a terrible misconstrual of what Wittgenstein said. He may be wrong. I happen to think that he had a lot to offer us. But if he's wrong, he didn't make that stupid a mistake. You always have to wonder when an author treats another author as a schoolboy making an elementary error, whether somebody's not being unfair. I assure you, Wittgenstein would not have been upset by that at all. He would say, yeah, this one Baptist, I mean, it's like if you have two circles, and they overlap a lot, but there's a little bit, just a thin part of the circle here that extends beyond this one. Well, when you start putting all the different forms of life that live together in this society of ours, we're going to have that kind of thing. But that doesn't change the fact that there are different rules and internal procedures and expectations. In fact, we can prove that basic thesis just by what we've seen already in Michael Martin's book. Consider my linguistic habits. And you may laugh at them sometimes, but nevertheless, consider my linguistic habits. At some points in my analysis over the last couple days, Michael Martin has said things which I've gotten real animated about and say, how can he do that kind of thing? Right? Or why doesn't he see that that requires him to have, a Christian theistic worldview? Now ask yourself, when Michael Martin made these remarks, were his linguistic habits to make those remarks and say, how can I not see that God exists? How can I possibly do this kind of thing? Now what's the difference here? Well, on a more primitive approach, you might say, well, he and I just have different beliefs about these matters, and so he doesn't go on to say the things that I do, and he doesn't act the way I do. But I think that's way too simplistic. Because we don't disagree on all of our beliefs. If we did, then you might account for our verbal differences by saying, well, but how do you account for the fact that we agree on some, and yet he says certain things that lead him to have a certain kind of verbal behavior, in some cases not even to notice that there's a big problem. And in my case, I want to stop and say, no, you can't, don't make a U-turn and get away from this one. What are you going to do with that? Well, the reason for it is I live in a form of life, broadly put, I'm an evangelical, reformed Christian, and a presuppositionalist at that, and I'm accustomed to, when I see that sort of thing being said, jumping on it. He's accustomed to saying that sort of thing and saying, hey, no problem. We have different linguistic procedures. We have different habits in our lives. That doesn't mean that we can't talk to each other or that we can't understand one another. I mean, that's just such an absurdly simple view of Wittgenstein that I hope you won't buy into it. Middle of the page. He says, second criticism is that since each form of life is governed by its own standards, there could be no external criticism. Yet this has unacceptable consequences. Last line. If this is so, external criticism of a practice such as Nazism would be impossible. I put in my margin, this is not a consequence of the theory. This is the theory. Because if Nazis want to, in fact they have, why do you think there still are Nazis today? You ever stop to think about that? If Nazis wish to have their own form of life where they inure themselves from the external criticism of other communities, or if you will, language games of various sorts, they're perfectly able to do it, and they do live their lives that way. Wittgenstein talked about that. In fact, that's why we have different political parties and different religious parties and so forth, because they have different language games and so forth. And so when he says, well, you know, one of the unacceptable consequences of this is that external criticism of Nazism might be excluded. I mean, the Nazis might open themselves up to listening, but they could also say, well, that's not the way we, you know, reason. That's not, those are not the important paradigms to us and so forth. When he says that's a problem with the theory, you have to understand all he's saying is, I don't agree with this theory. Let's ask this. Is it descriptively accurate? Man, I tell you, we got an outstanding illustration of what Wittgenstein's talking about right in this book. Yes, it's descriptively accurate. Atheists and theists don't use language the same way. They do have different conventions, a different form of life. I get done reading this book, and my inclination is to go upstairs and get on my knees and thank God that he saved me from this foolishness. Now, Michael Martin read this book, and you notice none of his verbal behavior is like that at all. We have different forms of life. We have different ways of evaluating. We talk differently about them. And if he wishes, he can treat his views in a way that they are protected from external criticism. And I would argue that if you look at what he's doing, that's exactly what he wishes to do. Because what happens every time, let's go back to Creel's interpretation of Richard Taylor. When Creel gave an interpretation of Richard Taylor that really put, you know, the screws to Michael Martin, what did he do? No external criticism. Let's look for another interpretation. Well, that's linguistic behavior, looking for another interpretation. So, when he says, on Wittgenstein's view, the Nazis might, you know, protect themselves from external criticism to say, yeah, that's right. Language games can work that way. In fact, we often see that they do work that way.
Also, though, wouldn't you have to say, just go back to world news, how in his world we can critically criticize anybody, much less the Nazis?
Yeah, actually, your remark is right on. The next paragraph, I was going to illustrate that for you. He continues to show us the unfortunate consequences of his misinterpretation of Wittgenstein. He says there can be no external criticism, And he says, well, some religious denominations practice sexual and racial discrimination. It is not implausible to suppose that most enlightened people today believe that this practice and the beliefs on which it rests are wrong. Specifically, the Mormons here. Why don't Mormons talk that way? What's the difference between their linguistic behavior and Michael Martin's? I mean, this is nothing less than question begging. But it's question begging that Wittgenstein explains. I mean, sometimes question begging, a whole bunch of people in different linguistic communities can recognize when it's so blatant, like, well, I believe the Dodgers will win the World Series. What's my premise for that? The Dodgers will win the World Series. Okay, there's question begging that's just so blatant. But other times the question begging is subtle, and it calls for an explanation. Why are people not realizing that they're begging the question? Well, interestingly, Wittgenstein gives us an explanation for that. Because to their way of thinking, this is not really a questionable premise. Of course women are inferior. Right? Or of course blacks are inferior. Now, I don't happen to hold to either one of those. I'm only using that for illustrative purposes. Okay, Christine? But when you have communities that hold those views, until they get into a crisis period, the Mormon Church is going through just such a crisis period, but until they get into a crisis period like that, the people who practice sexual or racial discrimination, they just take it for granted. It's not even something that you have to, you know, ask yourself about. So when Michael Martin says, well, on Wittgenstein's view, you might have it's possible that people would just take for granted these views that others of us, enlightened people, find abhorrent.
I have a good example of that because I happen to be a Missouri Senate Lutheran.
Okay.
Missouri Senate Lutherans do not feel that women should be pastors. Now, obviously Michael Martin would consider that they're prejudiced, but we definitely have what we feel are scriptural and, language forms that explain that we do not consider women unequal. There is a different reason.
Right.
Obviously, he would never understand that with my language form.
Right. Well, when you say a woman cannot be a pastor, by the way, I agree with you. And my rejection of sexual discrimination is on the view that women are somehow chattel and less than men and so forth. But when I say that, or you say that, Michael Martin, as you say, given his inference patterns, he doesn't have to draw any subtle distinctions. He finds that abhorrent. And for him, when we say, well, of course, what we mean by is that those meanings, it's not like they're over his head, but they just don't touch him. They're not effective with him. Given his form of life, that way of speaking is just not an effective defense.
Real quick, going back to the previous thing kind of about there's no external criticism. In one sense, he's just running over this so quickly that it's just anthemously. Wittgenstein doesn't say there can't be any criticisms. He just said you can never... you can't stand outside of a language game and decisively show that their language game is erratic. There's no problem with saying, oh, you believe that way? Well, you shouldn't believe that way and give them reasons. Now, it's not going to be compelling to the guy. And Wittgenstein's friends will end up saying, fool, heretic. But he doesn't criticize something.
Yeah, you can offer the criticism. He also admits that the person can be somewhat affected by the criticism. But if you mean offer a criticism, put it in your words, which will decisively change his mind, no, you can't.
Yeah, Martin just seems to smile over them.
Yeah.
It's just misleading, I think.
Again, if you look at my article in Wittgenstein, I have the quotation that Mike's alluding to, where Wittgenstein says, you eventually just get down to rock bottom, and all you can do is call each other heretic. You know, different forms of life, all they can say is, that's just wrong. Or, if you will, to use the Kuhnian approach, given our exemplars, that just doesn't make sense. That's not an explanation, given our form of life. And I think Kuhn and Wittgenstein, without the relativistic conclusion, are really on target here. It really helps us to explain disputes and social difficulties and why one school of thought is never able to absolutely twist the arm of the other school of thought and make him cry uncle. Do notice again in the bottom 257 how Michael Martin tells us that most enlightened people will disagree with this.
What?
Is this linguistic behavior to use the word enlightened? Why does he distribute the word enlightened over the world in a way that Mormons don't distribute the word enlightened? I mean, it's just so obvious from what he's doing that he's proving Wittgenstein's very point.
Does that also explain why, in debate, even if he sees your argument, he'll turn away from it?
Yeah, I think that's what happens. I don't know what will happen specifically in his case. But this happens both ways in just about any debate. Whenever one debater thinks, well, I've got this guy, you know? And then he's kind of deflated to find out the other guy doesn't feel any pain. They say, I'm twisting you, man. I mean, you've got to say it now. The other guy goes, well, that may be a little bit of a problem. But now here's the real problem. And then he puts, you know, the hold on the other guy. He goes, well, I got him. What are you going to say to that? He says, I don't think that's very important.
And that's what Savage did when he showed that he had a problem with the basis of morality. So
yeah, right.
You have a greater problem. How can a good God send anyone to hell?
Well, you're all catching on. We don't have to become Wittgensteinian in the full sense to appreciate this and to see that this is not a good criticism of Wittgenstein and therefore is not a good criticism of the presuppositional nature of the argumentation between the believer and the unbeliever. He says at the very bottom of 257, despite what Wittgenstein and Fedius say, external criticism is not only...
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.